Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, January 5th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me remotely from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Josh Bowling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Patrick, yesterday's storm, another lesson in how the weather, even with all our technology, remains unpredictable. Less snow than we expected, but flooding like we haven't seen in a long, long time.
Some people were saying in 40 years, and they were looking back to 1978 as the last time they saw flooding in some of these areas like they saw yesterday. And it caused real problems. People were in their vehicles, they were in their homes, and they were getting trapped at various locations. Route 6A on the north side from Sandwich through Barnstable. Yarmouth, not as bad. Dennis and Brewster had some areas of Route 6A as well that were closed down. There were vehicles that were stranded in the roadway, and we could hear it on the scanner, and our photographers and reporters were outside looking for these types of incidents, and cars had water coming up to the windows, and people had to be rescued from these vehicles. There's an extremely dramatic photo on the front of today's paper showing a Porsche in the middle of a roadway at the Dennis Brewster line. And before our photographer had arrived there, a fire official said that the water was almost up to the roof. So these were very dramatic events in Morris Island in Chatham. There had to be people rescued from the island. There are about 50 to 75 people who live out there during the winter, and about seven people, I think, total had to be rescued from Morris Island via boats. Firefighters had gone in originally with some tin boats, thinking they could walk people out, and then they thought that, well, we can use high water vehicles that were being deployed across the state. But they finally decided they needed basically their swim tactical rescue team to go in and go in and rescue people just on boats. Barnstable Village also had flooding, and I think it was the Commerce Road area. And I think about 30 people had to be rescued from that area and provided with some temporary shelter. They did not open regional shelters yesterday. They have a system in place. The county has a planning committee that looks at whether a storm requires regional shelters to be opened. But that didn't happen. I think it was basically pockets of areas where either evacuations were necessary or people had to be rescued, but it didn't rise to the point where they thought that they had to open these regional shelters. But it really was dramatic. Again, coastal flooding, obviously here on the Cape and Islands, we get hit by that more than in other places. Nantucket saw, I think, the highest wind gust in the northeast at 76 miles an hour. And the Cape saw 75 miles an hour in Wellfleet and I think North Falmouth or somewhere along those lines. So again, a lot of water came in. That water was followed by snow in the afternoon for us. Again, it was snow elsewhere for most of the day, but we had the rain in the morning, the flooding at high tide around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the snow moved in and the temperatures started to drop as night fell. And certainly it was slick when I was leaving our offices last night and the roads this morning. In some areas are still very slick, and the temperatures are expected to drop even more and get down to either the single digits or with the wind chill as low as negative 15, if you can believe it. So it's really quite an interesting weather situation out there. Again, I was driving in, I saw a dusting of snow, it seemed like, in most places. So the large amounts of snow of 4 to 8 inches that were predicted, at least where I was driving, didn't exist. But certainly the rain, the flooding, had enough of an impact on people.
And what is on the ground in many places is just frozen solid right now and will be through the weekend, it sounds like. I was struck by how quickly the flooding happened. You had a quote in the article from an officer talking about going from 6 inches to 6 feet in half an hour.
Yeah, and that was in Chatham, and I think one of the things they were pointing at was a breach, a recent breach, which Chatham, obviously the outer beach there, has a lot of these types of breaches, but this breach occurred right across from the causeway to Morris Island, which is, it's not really an island, there is a causeway, but this breach that occurred, maybe it was in April, caused the ocean to basically flood right in, and with the way this storm was set up, that area had the water being pushed in. It was an astronomical high tide. It was one of these really high tides for the month. And that combination at that time pushed water in through there very rapidly, like you said, and had that effect of going from a small amount to a really high amount very quickly. Also on the bay side, I think that was the same sort of thing that occurred there. And there was a boardwalk in Yarmouth Port that was really heavily damaged. And one of the things you were also dealing with was the ice on the bay in particular. In some ways, it was a good thing because I think one of the officials from Brewster said that the ice kept the waves from hitting the shoreline, and that's where you see a lot of erosion taking place. So the ice kind of muted the power of the waves. But in other places, that same ice was moved around, and it was hitting pilings, and it was coming all the way onto roads. And as the tide receded, you found big chunks of ice on the roadway. So it was a lot of different effects from this storm.
I want to move on from the storm right now, and I want to talk about a story. Patrick, you covered county government. There was a fascinating example of county government in action this week as the Barnstable Assembly of Delegates discussed a resolution opposing a move by the Barnstable County Sheriff, and the public turned out in force to weigh in. Tell us about this.
Yeah, and this has been building for a little while. There was a previous meeting that basically fell apart because people were so exercised about this issue, and they are nationally, obviously, but here on the Cape as well, the issue of immigration draws a lot of people from different sides. And in this case, the County Assembly of Delegates, which is the legislative arm of county government, and so they're in charge of, you know, enacting ordinances and working with the county commissioners, who's the executive arm. This 15-member group had a resolution before them that was to oppose a program that the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office, which is separate from the county at this point, it's a state agency more or less at this point, the Sheriff's Office had entered into an agreement called a 287G program with Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials so that the sheriff, when he finds somebody in his jail, with or without bail, they're there either before they go to trial or after they've gone to trial and been convicted. He finds somebody there who's in the country illegally. He can then start the process of basically processing them that can eventually lead to their deportation. Essentially, the officials at the sheriff's office become deputized as immigration officials, federal immigration officials, more or less. And so a lot of people have raised concerns about this. The assembly was voting on this resolution, which was to oppose that program. It didn't really mean anything because the assembly has no jurisdiction over the sheriff. It has no jurisdiction over federal immigration laws. It was more a statement on the assembly's part that would have been made. But as it turns out, the assembly rejected the motion or rejected the measure, the resolution. They rejected in one way and didn't in another way. The assembly is made up of members whose vote is weighted based on the population of their respective town. And so as that percentage, they voted 57-40% against the measure. But as a popular vote, 9 of the members voted for it and 5 voted against it. So, you know, in the popular vote, they voted for the opposition to this program. But in reality, they voted it down. So again, there was a lot of people at this meeting on Wednesday. There were 50 people in the meeting room. It was actually, you know, so packed that our photographer couldn't even get in. And then there was a group of 50 people who were up on the hill at the old jail there in the Barnstable County complex watching via video. So it drew a lot of people from both sides, people who were concerned about the effects of this program and people who said, listen, you know, this is good. This is something where the safety of our communities is at stake. And we really need to have the sheriff basically follow the law. And when he finds somebody who's here in the country illegally, this is the right thing to do. Again, opponents of the program said we're worried about the effect on our immigrant community and the effect on policing and all sorts of concerns that they raised. But in any case, it doesn't really mean anything. The sheriff's going forward with his program. He says this is about safety, and that's what he puts first and foremost. But I don't think it's the last we'll hear about this. There's certainly, again, a national conversation that's being had about this.
Let's speak now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, how did you fare with the storm there?
Well, it was just like everywhere else. There was a lot of flooding around the shore. We particularly had a problem in the Little Beach, Morris Island area, where at one point there was at least 4 feet of water at that intersection, which basically cut off the Morris Island and Stage Harbor neighborhoods. And actually this morning that area is still under underwater in some to some extent. The roads closed, power was cut to the area because of flooding, flooding not just of basements but of homes. This morning, the town's electrical inspector was going house by house to check out the situation down there. This is an area south of the lighthouse, if people aren't familiar with it. It's pretty low-lying, and with the extent of the storm surge and the waves, the water was just washing over the Barrier Beach, the South Beach area, and going right into that neighborhood. So other than that, there was a lot of water, a lot of wind and trees down. But other than that area, the town pretty much escaped with not too much problem.
Looking at other news, Tim, shuffling of selectmen out in Chatham and Harwich. Bring us up to date of what's happening here.
Sure. First in Chatham, Amanda Love, who was elected to the Board of Selectmen in 2016, announced this week that she was resigning from the board, effective immediately. She said it was for personal reasons, saying between her full-time job in Eastham as in the assessing department there and continuing education that she's pursuing, she doesn't have time to devote what she feels is necessary to the job. Now, selectmen have the option of calling a special election to fill the unexpired term. There's about a year and a half to go on that term, or putting it on the May election ballot. It's going to cost about $6,000 to hold a special election, and the town clerk said with all the statutory requirements, it couldn't be held until March 15th. So selectmen have to decide if they want to go ahead with that or wait another 2 months for the annual election. They're going to make that decision on Monday. In Harwich, Selectman Janelle Brown announced this week that she would not seek re-election at the May annual town meeting. She's a one-term selectman. She said the reasons for her were financial as well. She said with her job and the demands of the selectman, it was costing her too much with childcare. She has two young children. And so she said she simply could no longer afford to devote that much time to the Board of Selectmen. She said she's learned a lot in her last couple of years on the board, and she's actually applying to law school with the intent of studying municipal law, she said. So that will leave that term open at the May 15th annual election in Harwich.
Tim Wood with the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we will hear from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, in Falmouth, the contention over the town-owned wind turbines took another turn this week. Seemed as though the town's building commissioner's own words were being used against him, as a neighbor of the two turbines petitioned to have them both dismantled. Tell us what's bring us up to date here.
Yeah, and I'm not sure they're being used against the building commissioner, Rod Palmer, but certainly the opponents of, or one opponent in particular, of the continued existence of these two turbines at the town's wastewater treatment facility is using a decision that Palmer had made to push for a second turbine. The first one, Palmer had already said he can have the town take down under a zoning bylaw. Initially, Mark Cool, who lives nearby, had pushed for that turbine to come down under a wind energy systems bylaw. He said it hasn't been used for a couple of years, and under that particular bylaw, it would be considered abandoned. And Palmer came back on that one and said, hey, listen, you don't even have to go there. The zoning bylaw allows me to decide that if something's, quote unquote, non-conforming, and that's been a decision that's gone through the courts. This has been a long-running fight since 2010, 2011, when these two turbines went into place and neighbors begin to experience problems that they attribute to the turbines, sickness, illness, that sort of thing. And he said, you don't even need to go to the wind bylaw. Zoning bylaw allows me to push for a turbine, something like this, to come down if it's considered non-conforming. This has been decided through the courts. There's still an appeal going on. But he said, I can force the town to do that. Mark Kuhl said, well, if you can do it in that case, you can do it in the second turbine's case, because the second turbine has also been kind of found to fall into this category. And if I don't need the wind bylaw for that, then I shouldn't need it for the second turbine as well. So he's now pushing for the town to take similar action. He said he was a little surprised that Palmer didn't mention the second turbine when he came out with that initial finding. But in any case, he's now pushing for that to move forward. So we'll see where that goes. Palmer had already said that he was requiring the town to take action on the first turbine. Now he's being pushed by the same individual, Mr. Kuhl, to take action on the second turbine.
And the turbines to be dismantled are going to cost the town quite a bit of money.
Absolutely. And they were supposed to save money for the towns, obviously, in saving energy costs. The town still owes about $10.5 million related to construction and operation of the two turbines. The cost to dismantle them hasn't specifically been calculated, but it was estimated by the town manager previously to be somewhere in excess of $1 million. And again, there's still savings that were going to be lost, basically, when these turbines come down. But again, neighbors say, hey, listen, we've been living with the problems from these turbines. They weren't put in properly. They weren't permitted properly. They need to come down. There are still supporters of the turbines who are pushing and appealing some legal rulings. And there's an environmental organization called the Green Center that's appealed a judge's ruling to permanently shut down the turbines. They've appealed that to state appeals court. So again, in similar fashion, it's not probably the end we'll hear about this, but we are getting towards a point where the next steps are really kind of that physical taking down of these turbines that Mr. Kuhl is pushing for.
Let's speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, with the new year comes the news that Martha's Vineyard Hospital has a new CEO. This comes after a fair amount of controversy in the last year.
Yeah, definitely. So, like you said, I think it was Tuesday, the 2nd, Martha's Vineyard Hospital announced they have a new CEO and president, Denise Schapici. And she will take over January 17th, and she has 30 years of experience at academic medical centers, and she most recently was chief administrative officer at the Metro West Medical Center, so she has a lot of experience. But this is important news, you know, first because this is the only hospital on the Vineyard, so obviously it's a really important organization, and there's a lot of, you know, people pay attention to what happens there for obvious reasons. But also because, like you said, a lot of controversy in the last about 6 months or so. In June, the previous CEO, who had only been on the job for a little over a year, Joe Wooden, was fired pretty abruptly. This caused a lot of controversy and some outcry on the Vineyard from people who, you know, wanted to know why he'd been fired, felt they needed more of an explanation and more transparency from the Board of Trustees. So there's been a lot of talk and a lot of scrutiny over the hospital since then. The new CEO, Ms. Schapici, said, you know, she's aware of this, that she thinks it's really important for hospitals as vital parts of the community to have a good relationship with the community, and that she's never worked at a hospital where they didn't have that relationship. So certainly she's aware of that and said she, you know, obviously hasn't really laid out her priorities yet because she hasn't taken over, but she does want to focus first and foremost on patient care. She said she wouldn't have come to the hospital if it didn't have that reputation of providing quality care and forming a relationship with the right people on the island, like community services and working with them. And she also said she's really excited that she actually, and this is definitely a bonus here, that she has a house on the Vineyard. She and her husband have a house in Vineyard Haven. She has summered on the Vineyard since college, so she is familiar with the island, and she does have a housing, which is always a really crucial thing. So, like I said, she hasn't taken over yet, but she will, I guess, in about 2 weeks, and there will be kind of maybe a new chapter at the hospital, and we'll see what happens.
Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for updating us on that.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. On the Point, I'm speaking to Patrick Cassidy at the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, we've just seen a spell of extremely cold weather and another couple of days now ahead of us. And you can't imagine what it would be like to spend these days and nights on the streets. You have an article from Jeff Spillane on the strain that the cold weather is placing on homeless services.
And we had looked at this earlier in the week, even before Thursday's storm. We have in Hyannis, in particular, a homeless population, and there's a shelter. It used to be called the Noah Shelter. It's now the St. Joseph's House and is run by Catholic Social Services. It has about 50 beds generally. They can expand it to include another 10 overflow beds if necessary. But it's been full. I mean, we've had cold weather before Thursday's storm. We're getting more cold weather now. And they've been really at capacity this whole time. And again, even listening to the scanner yesterday as police were kind of going around and finding people on the street who really needed to be inside. They were finding different places for them and taking them to motels and other places. And so as that shelter's filled up, there's been some concern about the funding and the ability to get people into warm places. There is kind of a backup to that shelter. Basically, if there's people who don't fit in the shelter, St. Joseph House employees will contact a caseworker with Duffy Health Center in Hyannis, and they'll try and find somebody who's the family member of that person who's out on the streets, or see if they can get that person into a motel room for a couple of days, kind of with this understanding that they'll work with social services agencies on a long-term plan. But even Duffy officials were saying they're concerned that this cold spell is putting a dent in their funding, and they're hoping that people will see this and donate and try and help out. But there are also about 10 to 15 people in Hyannis, again, in particular, who are kind of consistently out on the streets. They don't tend to want to come inside for a variety of reasons, and police are kind of worried about those people and dealing with those people. And a police officer who we spoke to, who works with this community policing group, said Hyannis also bears the brunt of this homeless issue, even though it's a countywide problem. This has been a long-running concern of people here in Hyannis in particular, saying, we are kind of shouldering this burden, and we really need help because these people are coming from all sorts of towns, and it's not just people from Hyannis, but they're coming here for services. And again, you end up in situations like this where it's extremely cold and these people are either out in the woods or on the streets, and they really do need some assistance. So there's been some funding that was released by the town and the Barnstable Police Department to try and, again, address this issue a little bit this week. But it can't be getting any easier to do so with the storm that we just saw and the temperatures going down like they are now.
Mm. With the plunging temperatures, another related story that a number of sharks have been found apparently succumbing to dropping temperatures in Cape Cod Bay. These are thresher sharks.
Yeah, and this story has really taken off. It's become a national, international story. I mean, anytime you say sharks are, it's so cold that sharks are freezing. I think somebody yesterday was saying it's so cold in New England that it's colder than Mars. These are the types of statements that really get people's attention. In this case, this was a fourth frozen thresher shark that was reported discovered on New Year's Eve in the ice pack of Wellfleet. Other sharks have been found in Orleans, Brewster, and another one in Wellfleet. They think this is a separate one, not the same shark that was found in Wellfleet earlier. And it makes some sense. You don't usually see these sharks washing up, but it seems that they do travel in kind of age groups. And so this group of sharks was probably together, according to researchers. And they say they also don't do well in lower temperatures. They can't moderate their own body temperature in a way to keep warm when they get into waters that are below 44 degrees for long periods of time. We've had that in Cape Cod Bay, and certainly these sharks have been affected. I was out on the beach in Orleans and saw the one that was out there, and it had been chopped up by researchers who were basically trying to get some necropsy done on it and trying to determine if it was anything else besides the cold or what the kind of research they could glean from the body. But again, this has really taken off. I think one of the researchers said that, again, anytime you have a headline that it's so cold that sharks are freezing to death, that's really going to kind of reverberate around the world.
It catches some attention, yes.
It certainly does.
And it's kind of related in some ways to the larger issue of strandings. And we see the larger numbers of sea turtles being stranded and people questioning why this is happening right now.
Yeah, and I mean, the sea turtles, that happens every year. They kind of wander in. Cape Cod Bay has a lot of good food for them, jellyfish and the like. And so they're wandering around, and every year you end up with these cold, stunned sea turtles. They usually come ashore a little earlier in the year. We have had a lot of high numbers. But again, the thresher shark is different. I've been here working at the paper for 12 years, and I've never heard of a thresher shark kind of washing up frozen on the shores of Cape Cod Bay, or even, I'm sure they're in the bay, but even them being in the bay that much. So it was really a different kettle of fish, if you will.
Let's speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, tell us, how did Provincetown fare with this storm? We saw some dramatic footage on Facebook of water running right through the streets on Commercial Street.
Yes, there's tremendous amount of damage. We're still assessing things, but people have up to 5 feet of water in their basements. There's a huge amount of flooding both on Commercial Street and Bradford Street, the two main streets in Provincetown. And it's going to be a kind of a disaster.
And then all this water that's there, is there a danger as it's frozen now?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's as the temperature drops, of course, it becomes more and more difficult to clean things up. We'll have to wait and see. People are out there dealing with it right now. And we will have a comprehensive report on it, of course, in next week's Banner. But people can also look at the Banner website on Wicked Local for updates, and at the Banner's Facebook page as well.
Ed, you had a story this week about officials at the Cape Cod National Seashore and the National Park Services looking to identify, there was an arson in the park. They're looking for information about who did this and why.
Yeah, this occurred right before Christmas. On Saturday, December 23rd, a person who was walking down Newcomb Hollow Beach in Wellfleet noticed smoke rising from the woods above the beach. And when Wellfleet firefighters and National Park Rangers came to the scene, they discovered the smoldering remains of a house, a house that had formerly belonged to the Brennan family and had been taken by the park, just completely burned to the ground, nothing left but the foundation and a chimney. And they searched the surrounding area and found the burned remains of a second abandoned structure known as the Porter Studio, not too far away, that had also just been burned to the ground. It's clear that the fires were set. This was, too much of a coincidence that two separate buildings burned down probably the night before, is what the fire chief told me. And so the park is very concerned about this and is asking the public to reach out with any information that they have with who might possibly have been responsible for this. There's the arson hotline at 800-682-9229. To get in touch with the National Park Service Investigative Services Branch. There's actually an arson watch reward that offers up to $5,000 for information leading to an arrest. Both of these structures were abandoned, they're typical of a number of derelict houses that are owned by the National Seashore. The origin of this is that, of course, when the National Park legislation was first introduced in Congress in 1959, there was a provision that any new buildings built between that time and the time that the park was officially created would be subject to taking by the government. So both of these houses were built in 1960. The park was created in 1961, and quite a few such buildings, homes, were then subsequently taken by the park, and a lot of them have just been left to you know, fall apart, basically. Mm. There's no money available in the national park system budget to really take them down and clean up the sites. So it's a disturbing story in a way, because luckily that night, the night of December 22nd, was a rainy night. And if the conditions had been dry, the fire chief told me, it's very likely that these fires could have spread and caused a very serious situation. There are other occupied homes in that area of the seashore in Wellfleet.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There is more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, word out this week that NOAA, the government agency that regulates fishing, has approved a plan to protect fish and fishing habitats. This has been a long time coming, and there are some Cape fishermen who feel like this could be a very good thing.
Yeah, it's 16 years in particular in terms of the amount of time it's taken to put together this habitat plan. And again, this is looking at kind of the critical life stages of fish and shellfish and how to protect them. It was announced Wednesday that this plan was available, announced by NOAA, essentially. They had approved most of the fish habitat protection plan. And as you said, on the Cape in particular, it was met by some cheers from fishermen who are looking in particular at a decision to close the Great South Channel, which is an area where fishermen do go, close that to fishing, but also to open up a closed area that had been close to scalloping. And they say, listen, this is an area where these scallops are just, you know, sitting there. Lots of them are there. We can go take advantage of this. It's not an area, they say, and the plan seems to support, where you're going to have problems with other fish species or destroying habitat of other fish species. So they say, why not open up this area? Not everybody was thrilled with it. There were some environmental groups who believed that the National Marine Fisheries Service hadn't followed the best available science, and they were even saying this could result in some litigation, and in particular they were worried about some habitat around a prominent ocean feature that's been in the news in the last year or so, Cash's Ledge, which were reduced to lessen the effect on fishermen. But even those groups saw some positive elements to the plan, including the decision to close the Great South Channel to this mobile bottom gear group like scallop dredges and fish draggers. And then there were other kind of fishing groups or other groups in particular who were saying, well, the scallop area being opened is good, but you should have opened even more of that. And for the same reasons, they say if we're going out there and we're scalloping in those areas, we're not going to be dragging in other areas where there could be an effect on other fish species. So still a lot of back and forth, but generally fishermen on the Cape have been pushing for a lot of these elements, and they seem pleased that they had gotten what they were looking for here.
Let's speak now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, George.
George, what can you tell us about how the island fared through the storm yesterday?
Yeah, it was quite a storm. Not the snow that was anticipated, but a lot of flooding and a lot of wind. Some of the wind gusts on the island were hurricane force. I think one of them recorded in Aquinnah was 67 miles an hour. There was a lot of street closings near the shore as a result of the coastal flooding. And today, it's a frozen tundra. I mean, there's just every sidewalk is crusty and, you know, the ones that haven't been cleared, I should say. And, you know, it's treacherous out there. The schools were delayed this morning as a result for 2 hours. And, you know, there were Chappie Ferry didn't run for quite a while. Obviously, the Steamship Authority wasn't running all day yesterday, but today has started operating again to the island. So not the impact that was expected ahead of time. There was worry about a lot of power outages, I think at the peak yesterday, there were 97 customers without power in West Tisbury, which is pretty amazing given the amount of wind that was whipped up yesterday by that storm.
It fared better than Dennis, where there were about 6,000 people without power at one moment in the storm there. George, you have a story about the Tisbury Police Department has fired Officer Mark Santon. Among other things, he's found to have lied repeatedly to investigators. Tell us about this.
Right. So a few weeks ago, we reported that he had been fired, but no one was saying why. Through a public records request, we got our hands on the internal affairs investigation that showed there were several things that were going on here, one of them being insubordination with a supervisor at the department, and in another instance, he had also purchased some expensive sneakers, $119 sneakers, using his uniform allowance, saying that he needed those sneakers to do drug investigations with the Martha's Vineyard Drug Task Force. Only problem is he's no longer a member of the Martha's Vineyard Drug Task Force. And there was the incident that we did know about going into this was OUI arrest that he had made where he fabricated some of the details of the arrest, saying that the engine was the hood of the car was hot to the touch and that the keys were in the ignition. Neither of those facts was true, and that case had been dismissed by the court as a result. Another officer was at the scene and disputed the evidence in the case. So there were wide-ranging things with Officer Santon, and listeners may remember that he had been under investigation earlier in the year for a separate incident and was suspended for 5 days. One of the points that the chief made in his internal affairs report is that discipline like that no longer seemed to be working with Officer Santon, and he continued to make untruthful statements. Something that, you know, can't be condoned by a police officer.
Mm.
So ultimately, he was fired.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times bringing us that story. George, thank you for that.
No problem, Steve. Take care.
Yep. This is the News Roundup. We are speaking with Patrick Cassidy at the Cape Cod Times. And Patrick, in Falmouth, the Zoning Board of Appeals weighed in on the contention over a pistol range, and it reversed the decision of the building commissioner.
You know, leave it to Falmouth again to have a complicated zoning issue. In this case, it has to do with a pistol range and a rifle range and whether or not they could go for neighbors of this particular club, the Midway Trap and Skeet Club in Falmouth, said that they were concerned about the amount of activity there and the noise and other concerns. And they were really pushing to kind of shut both of those down. The building commissioner basically had sent a cease and desist order to the sports club in July saying the pistol range needed to stay off limits and that the club needed to get a permit for that before it could go forward. He didn't take action on the rifle range that, you know, neighbors wanted to have shut down as well. But he basically said, you know, this pistol range wasn't in effect before 1971, which is when it would have had to have been in effect to be grandfathered in. So he did that, but then it was appealed to the zoning board, and they decided to overturn Palmer's decision. And they basically said, you know, we've heard from the people who use this range, and they've been using it since 1960, and we've taken their letters and their affidavits, and that's enough for us. We believe that they were using this particular range. Palmer had pointed to a berm that had been put in place, and that even if you didn't take into account the 1971 zoning bylaw that they would have had to have been in before then, that this berm was a substantial enough upgrade to require the club to apply for a special permit. Zoning board members disagreed. They said it's a modest safety improvement, and we don't think that's enough. So again, Palmer's decision has been overturned. And the decisions on the two appeals in terms of whether the neighbors want to appeal them have to be filed within 20 days of the two appeals decisions being filed with the town clerk's office by January 15th. So we're looking at, you know, beginning of February, they'd have to file their appeals. Those appeals would have to be filed in Superior Court or Land Court again, an issue that probably isn't going away, but we'll see how much fight the neighbors have in them.
Outer Cape Health is expanding its services and the facilities from which it operates. What's the story here?
Yeah, this group has been looking to expand their services for quite some time and had some false starts in that area. They are currently now occupying the second floor of what was known as the Kennedy Building. It's a large office building on Route 28 across from Sacotucket Harbor. Later this year, they hope to open up spaces on the bottom floor with 18 examination rooms for doctors and patients. And they're hoping to have a kind of a ribbon cutting on all of this by November. But they are in the building. They serve about 17,000 patients and have 70,000 visits annually at offices they have in Provincetown, Wellfleet, and Harwich. But their Harwich Center, they've said, is too crowded with only 5 examination rooms. And this new building will allow them to certainly expand their services. It's a big big part of this renovation that they're doing for their health centers. It's about $13 million worth of work, including some at the Wellfleet Community Health Center. But as I said, they had originally planned a much kind of more ambitious project that would have been, I think, somewhere on the order of $38 million that included new offices in Harwich and Brewster and a new health center built on the existing Wellfleet site. But now they've scaled that back. They had bought land in Brewster, and they bought the Stonehorse Motel in Harwich. And those two properties are now up for sale again, and they've gone to this kind of more reduced idea.
Let's talk about a story that you have about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe beginning employee layoffs. And what's behind this?
Yeah, and it seemed like this, we kind of saw this coming, saw the writing on the wall. There was mm-hmm. some discussion last year, even by the tribe chairman in a note to tribe members, I think, about kind of having to tighten the belt a little bit and making sure that things are being run efficiently. We obtained a letter that was addressed to the employees who will be terminated. Their last day is officially, I think, December 29th, this past December 29th, but they're on the payroll until January 12th. And essentially the letter said, you know, we value your commitment, and this layoff is permanent. It's not related to your performance. And essentially the tribe was pointing at the need to be really conservative with their budgeting when they're facing a continued legal fight over their proposed casino in Taunton. And they've gotten a lot of, you know, revenue from investors for that casino, and that casino is really up in the air as far as whether it's going to move forward. There have been legal challenges, you know, successful in some ways, certainly successful in stymieing continuing construction on the casino that had started, I think, a year or two ago. And so now they're saying we really need to rein in costs, and tribe members who our reporter spoke to said the jobs that are being cut are backed by investor dollars. The tribal chairman, through a spokesman, did not clarify how many positions we're talking about. And tribal government is sovereign, and therefore it's not something that where you can make a public records request the way you can with state, local, or federal government in other cases. In this case, we're really beholden to either, you know, people who are talking to us or the tribe itself in terms of giving us information. They have, 17 departments at the tribe's government headquarters, and they run on a budget of about $12 million a year. That's according to the chairman, what he told us in November. But again, he says they really need to make sure that they're geared up for this continued legal battle over the casino, and they're certainly hoping for a successful conclusion to that. Obviously, neighbors out there in Taunton are not.
Hmm. Patrick, Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater has found itself in the midst of controversy. It planned a fundraising trip for the spring, and it's now become the subject of some outspoken criticism.
Yeah, and this is criticism coming from people who, you know, have either been supportive or part of the theater group out there in Wellfleet. This was basically a planned culinary and cultural adventure tour through Israel that was advertised last week in an email. And again, the reaction from 15, 20 folks or so was that the itinerary, the way it was presented, essentially seemed to not address the issue of Palestine and the ongoing, obviously, international conversation and debate and violence at times that occurs between the Jewish residents of Israel and Palestinian people there. And so essentially some of these people, including one of whom is Jewish, said, hey, listen, you're being tone deaf. You're really not, by not addressing the Palestinian issue, by not including the idea that you'll talk to Palestinian people while you're there, you're making it look like you're supporting Israel. Now, it's important to point out that, Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater officials say, hey, listen, that wasn't our point. This was a cultural, culinary adventure that we were proposing. It had nothing to do with politics. We didn't mean to imply that it was political in nature, and we didn't mean to imply support for one group or another. And they also point out that some of these people who are even being critical have been to Israel themselves and saying, well, we don't want to deprive other people who might, gain from that opportunity, the same sort of opportunity. And it's really an opportunity to go there and meet the people, of all types, and really get to know the people versus just hearing it in the news. So they say if they get enough people to sign up by their deadline, mm-hmm. they will move forward with the trip. But again, it's been a very vociferous reaction from people who are critical of it, who are worried that it's sending the wrong statement.
And let's talk about a story about parents of students in the Dennis Yarmouth School District that had some reason to be confused this week. A television station reported that school was canceled returning from Christmas break. And it turns out that this may have been, somebody hacking the alert system? Is that right?
Well, there's still some confusion as to what exactly was hacked. The school officials themselves say their system that they use, which is called Blackboard Connect, was not hacked. And they think that maybe the TV station's systems were hacked in terms of getting this information to them. Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District was the only school district in the state that was affected by this, from the sounds of it. It was actually in two different TV stations that had this alert. But for different days, Boston 25 said that the school would be closed Thursday on yesterday. Some irony there. And WBZ had announced Monday that the district would be closed on Tuesday, the first day back from Christmas break. In both cases, that wasn't originally correct. Ironically, and this is the true use of the word, Thursday's storm did cause the closure of the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District. So maybe they were just incredibly prescient, and I know it's on a delayed opening today. But at the time, there was this confusion. Are we coming to school on Tuesday or not? It sounds like the students weren't affected. Police are investigating exactly what happened. But it does seem like it was just DY, and we didn't get calls back from the TV stations. But there's some confusion, and they did react quickly. A school committee member said that once the TV stations were alerted to the issue, they responded very quickly and took care of it right away.
Yes, that the school district committee chairman put a posting on the parent Facebook page that, yes, Virginia, there is school tomorrow.
Yes, and obviously all the students out there were probably a little disappointed. They thought they had maybe an extra day before having to go back to school. But as it turns out, again, through social media, the police, through the parents' page, they were able to get the information out there, and it sounds like everybody who was normally going to show up for school did show up for school.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you to our other contributors. We heard from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Ed Miller joined us from the Provincetown Banner, and we spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.